The World Health Organization defines health equity as a public health concept describing equity of access to health resources for genetic, socio-environmental, and economic determinants of health, varying according to individuals, families, and social or societal groups. Concerns about data equity have surfaced, which may result in many populations, including those in rural areas with disabilities, experiencing homelessness, or living in low and middle income regions of the world, being underrepresented in health data sets, leading to biased findings and suboptimal health outcomes for certain subgroups. In today's episode of the podcast, we consider where do we encounter problems in data equity and how can we address them? I am John Baylor. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association, as well as Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media Journalism and Film. I'm joined by Rosemary Pennington, Chair of the Department of Media, Journalism, and Film. Our guest today is Dr. Brahmar Mukherjee, the inaugural Senior Associate Dean of Public Health Data Science and Data Equity, and the Anna M. R. Lauder Professor of Biostatistics, Professor of Epidemiology, Chronic Diseases, and of Statistics and Data Science at Yale University. Among her many honors, she was elected to the U.S. National Academy of Medicine in 2022. Brahmar, it is a delight to welcome you on the podcast.
Thank you, John and Rosemary. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast. And thank you for all the work that you have been doing over the years to excite and inspire the next generation of statisticians.
Oh, you're too kind. Yeah. I'm curious. When did you first start to encounter data equity issues and their impacts?
Yes, so I think a transformative experience happened for me during COVID when on a 24-hour notice, I and my team decided that we are going to start modeling the SARS-CoV-2 trajectory in India. And the reason for that there was a extreme form of data paucity and data opacity, and also a vacuum in the modeling space that we were noticing. And statisticians were largely absent from the scene. People who were talking about the models were clinicians, physicists, economists, but this is our lane. So we started to model the pandemic in India. And gradually I realized that we have the sophistication of various compartments of a dynamical model, but we do not have the data to afford those models. And so that really dawned on me that this is the problem at the very start of the statistical process, that if that is corrupted or if that process is not strong, whatever we do downstream is going to suffer. And so I looked at the data distribution of various things that I have worked on all my life across the world over time and realized that, I'll just give you one number. I work a lot on genome-wide association studies. And since 2006, in the last 20 years, hundreds and thousands of human genomes have been genotyped. But 87% of them are from Caucasian ancestry. And South Asia, where 1 out of 5 or nearly 20% of the people in this world live, have less than 0.4% of the share of data. So I was just like thinking about this, that 20% population, 0.4% genetic data, how is this fair? And if we are discovering treatments and preventions based on gene-guided strategies, is it optimal for my parents? And so that really, that very personal experience drove me to formalize this notion and study this in much more depth, this notion of data equity.
It's interesting because when I first heard this term data equity, my assumption, given sort of other conversations about equity, was about access, right? Do all researchers or scholars have access to the same kind of data? But really, you're arguing that it's an issue of who is included in the data. So could you maybe share another example where this issue of data equity might impact people in a way that would make them care? Because I imagine for a non-statistically, you know, literate audience, this might be something they're like, well, why does that matter? Could you sort of talk us through a case where a concrete way that this would matter and impact people?
Yes, definitely. So, you know, as John mentioned, that health equity, we all agree that is a good notion. Data equity sort of mirrors the notion of health equity. And this is not just in terms of the access to data. It's fairness, transparency, accessibility in terms of collection, use, and distribution of data. And we believe that, like in an ideal world, the altruistic goal will be that everybody, regardless of their ideology, circumstances, or beliefs, or lived experiences, should benefit from this massive explosion that is happening in the information space, both in terms of the quality of the data and the availability of the data. I'll just give you one example. This is the classic example of pulse oximetry data. And so it was actually noted way back when these pulse oximeters were being developed that these oximeters do not really work well for people with darker skin tones. But we never did a proper medical device study on people with different shades of skin tone. And during COVID, when the patient population was largely black and brown communities, then we got lots of measurements and detected that there is a problem. When the oximeter is saying that your blood reading is 92 for a person with a darker skin tone, it's really 88. And so you're not getting to the hospital on time. And so this was really discovered when we have enough data and the patient mix in the ICUs and hospitals shifted from what it typically is. Had we collected that data, had there been representation of each of the subgroups, then we would have discovered this. And also there is also thinking about if we discover it, that does not empower a decision. So I also want to distinguish that data equity does not really empower somebody to take the decision that they deserve. So that's a different question.
So with researchers that are encountering this, are they surprised about the idea of that, I've been taking these data sets that are not representative, that I may recognize some of the limitations in the work that I do, but I'm not recognizing maybe a fundamental limitation in how it's even collected. So what's sort of the reaction to researchers that are encountering this for the first time?
You know, I think that I'm just thinking like by researchers, I'm going to broaden the horizon. If we think about statisticians, right, we are often used to work on the data that's given to us, right? So we often think about Y and X is given to us, but I think that we should be involved from the very onset of the study and think about what is the target population, what is the inference. I think statisticians and epidemiologists are probably the two disciplines of science who are very, very well trained to think about the origin of data, the collection of data, the sampling of data, the representation of data. In computer science, many times my friends actually take data at face value, that this is Y, this is X. If this is measured with error, or if it's coming from a selective population that's not representative of the target population, that those notions naturally do not arise in their mind, and they just think about, I'm going to predict. But I, as a statistician sitting in a school of public health, are going to think about my job is not just to predict, but to prevent as well. And for that, I need to have data from the population in which I'm trying to prevent a disease. So prediction and prevention, that if you want to connect that link, then of course you need to think about this. But I think that when you actually see the representation of data across the world, or you sort of think about the training corpora of these massive AI tools that we are using, GPT, Gemini, Claude, who are in this data set? Just think about like the latest Pew survey shows that 20% Americans have never heard about a chatbot. 66% have never used a chatbot. So when we are using these tools, the data, the user data is retraining these models again. So this cycle is reinforcing itself. And then people are left out when AI and all these tools are used for decision-making, for education, for medical discoveries. So this really is becoming quite acute, particularly in the last 3-4 years. And so people are becoming much, much more cognizant about this issue, that who is visible to AI and AI is visible to them.
Brahmar, you are one of the co-authors of a piece in JAMA Health Forum that came out earlier this year, The 10 Core Concepts for Ensuring Data Equity in Public Health. And I wondered if you could talk us through how you and your co-authors came up with these core concepts and why you felt like you needed to publish this.
Yes. Yeah, so thank you for that question, because I have been sort of like a thinking about this, and this has been hibernating inside me for the last 5 years. First of all, I have been thinking about data equity, and I did not know. I have been a practicing statistician for nearly 30 years, a student of statistics, but I had never encountered this term. And then when I researched, I saw that in September 2024, World Economic Forum actually released its first report on an action-oriented framework for data equity. But it did not have a statistical perspective so that throughout the data life cycle, I could implement strategies to prevent it. Concrete things. Being a statistician, I always try to combine this qualitative altruistic ideas with metrics and numbers and processes that we can implement from the design phase to the data collection phase to the prediction phase to the dissemination phase and to the policy adoption phase. So I was thinking, how can I think about metrics? And so we had a lot of discussion across clinicians, public health researchers, to think about, we really need to blend ideas from computer science regarding fairness, access, transparency, ethics, privacy, confidentiality of data with public health concepts such as selection bias, representativeness, generalizability, causal inference. These two have to be blended together. And then they have to be wrapped in the notion of reflexivity. So I realized that there is a whole field of philosophy called critical data studies. And so critical data studies and critical computing has appeared in the literature, but as a statistician, we are not trained in this to think about data as a topic of debate and discourse from a social and epistemological point of view. But then when we wrap these notions of concrete metrics in the notion of critical data studies and reflexivity, that's where I feel we are closer to think about data equity. But we also wanted to distinguish that having enough data does not imply that you have prediction equity. So for example, for the South Asian example that I gave you, I'm not sure that we really need 20% data. We may be able to do it much less because the human genome is largely similar across ancestry. So, but I can tell you that 0.4% is not enough. So what is the right optimal percentage of data that we should collect on a subgroup given the current distribution of data? And then even if we give somebody a prediction that you are at the highest risk, does that empower them to modify behavior, seek the care? That also is decision equity. So we wanted to distinguish these three phases of equity and think about concrete metrics and frameworks and principles that can be implemented so that you can say that, okay, I was self-auditing my own work as a statistician to implement these principles.
So given your awareness of data equity issues, and you know, you've probably designed more studies since you've really embraced and investigated this. How has this changed the way that you've approached a new study?
Yes. So, you know, I think I have always believed that you have to walk the talk. It is unusual for a statistician to go on the field and collect data. And I actually just decided to do that, that if I'm not happy with some of the data sets I'm using currently, I have to be part of efforts which are collecting more equitable data sets, because you cannot do everything from nothing. If you have a lack of representation, yes, we can weave our statistical magic to do weighting and calibration and bring in external data to fix the problem that as much as we can. But unless we have enough data on different population. So I actually, with my colleagues at the University of Michigan, where I was for 18 years, launched a study called MyCares, Michigan Cancer Research of the Environment Study. And this is led by my colleague and cancer epidemiologist Lee Pierce and Dana Dolinoy from the Environmental Health. It is actually recruiting participants from different parts of Michigan, and we consciously chose that we'll have 25% white, 25% black, 25% Latinx, and 25% Middle Eastern and North African population, which is a very special population living in the Dearborn area in Michigan. So I felt like efforts can be local to solve a global problem that we all have to do our part.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and we're talking with Brahmar Mukherjee about data equity and more. Brahmar, you do an amazing amount of work with public communication. You did this during COVID. You continue this now. What led to this passion for communicating to a general audience?
I grew up in a family of liberal arts, and my father is actually a very well-known actor on Calcutta stage. So in our family, we never got credit for numbers. Words were important and much more important than numbers. So at a dinner table, my father actually never looked at our grade reports. I was always good in terms of studies, so I wanted to show off, but he never paid any attention. His only criteria was that when people come over for dinner, at the dinner table conversation, we should know that you are being educated. So that's a very nebulous concept, but as we progress through our time and age, that criteria, he's 86 years old now, and he just produced a new adaptation of Waiting for Godot. And so he's very active, and I grew up in that sort of stage, expression, entertainment, that kind of philosophy. So I always wanted to make math and stat more interesting. And so I was very conscious about this, that in a classroom, I should make my best effort to make complicated concepts easy. And I feel like if you know things really well, you should be able to teach it well to people who are from different disciplines. And biostatistics is a field which really relies on collaboration. I do think that the four C's that we need for a biostatistician of the next age is computation, collaboration, communication, and a little bit of courage to think about stretching outside our comfort zone. So it was really during COVID when I felt that my communication skills came into play, and I was actually speaking quite openly in terms of the pandemic in India, in television shows, and also writing columns in Indian newspapers, also all across the world. Our model became the go-to model for journalists, stakeholders, policymakers. And one reason of that was effective communication and different forms of communication. It was not just going on a talk show or NPR, but also having visual description of the data, which is daily updated. So we created a website called covid19.org, which ran for more than 800 days with web scraping and automated updating. And it is, you know, we have to think about sustainable ways of updating data and running models. If it required human touch every day, it would not be possible. And because we were updating and doing nowcasting for more than 800 days, that experience of building a website, visual dissemination, communication, talking to policymakers was a priceless, invaluable experience for me. So I had the interest, but COVID was sort of the catalyst which made it all happen. And I also took a lot of media training through University of Michigan and other opportunities whenever I had.
Given what you told us about your family background, I am very curious how you got interested in biostats and public health.
Well, that's also sort of a reverse causality. At our dinner table, there was never a closure on any discussion. So I, as a person, somehow sought objectivity. And I felt that the language of mathematics was universal. And because I was always focusing on my grades in an English essay, I felt that it depended on the teacher, whether they like my style, like my thought, and they can, with the same essay, you can get a score from 2 to 10, given out of 10, given who the grader is. So I wanted to be a grader neutral answer, that regardless of who I am or who the instructor is, if I get the answer right, I should get points and I should get credit. So you could probably see that this passion for equity through mathematical truth, because the notion of truth is getting so lost. And probably that was a passion in me, that I wanted objective and concrete answer, swimming in this ocean of artists and critics who can never agree on anything.
This is a great story.
Yeah.
You know, as you think about some of the communication challenges, as you started to really embrace this and approach the challenge of addressing COVID with journalists, with broadcasters, what were some of the greatest communication challenges you faced, and what were some of the ways that you addressed those challenges?
So the first challenge that I faced is that I'm not a native English speaker. So I have to think about, there is a minute of like microprocessing that goes on in my head. And I always feel, if I could speak in Bengali. So that I had to overcome, that nobody is probably judging me based on my accent, but what I say, how I say, and if I can communicate through stories. But I'll tell you that during all of this interaction with media, there was one episode with BBC Bangla in Bangladesh where I was allowed to speak in Bengali. That was my best communication piece, where I could actually refer back to cultural anecdotes, politics, poetry in order to explain a pandemic. I realized after that episode that I'll never have that, probably at that level of comfort in English. But does that mean that I let perfect be the enemy of the good? I think I'm okay as a storyteller and I can still try, but I would also have to say that knowing the Indian context really, really helped me to engage with media in India. And so I completely decided to retain my focus on India. And this is something I would recommend people who are non-native English speakers, that you have to show that fourth C, a little bit of courage, and you'll see that people are receptive to your stories. And the second thing I wanted to really, really learn the hard way, because live television, you say something and you cannot take it back. So you have to be very, very careful and prepare extremely well. If possible, ask the journalist for the questions in advance so that you can stay prepared. But even with all of your best efforts, everything is politicized, right? So I was trolled so much because of my everything of commenting on COVID, when the next wave is going to come, because of the models, everything. So you have to be very resilient with respect to, if you are in the public eye, there will be a lot of criticism. So at some level, you have to adopt the principles of statistical learning, being robust and efficient both.
What advice would you have for journalists who are covering complicated public health stories filled with statistics? I mean, you've had lots of experience being interviewed by journalists, but journalists, you know, are trying to do this work well. And given your work to be an efficient and successful communicator of scientific fact, like what advice do you have for journalists?
That's a great question. So I think it's good to have, just like I have developed some very close friendships with journalists around the world, and we have stayed in touch. So if I have a communication question, I reach out to them. I believe in expertise. So similarly, I would recommend that journalists have data scientist friends that they can lean on, and deep expertise can never be substituted. But also, I think that there are many, many courses now on data translation and applied data science. So I think blending the journalism training with some data science training, which most serious data journalists actually do, could be a very good idea. And then the third part, I think, is domain science. Even with the data, even with the story, the clinical and contextual experience really is priceless and cannot be replaced. So I think it's really a triad of the domain knowledge, the data science knowledge, and the communication expertise, which comes to define a story.
So in your work in data equity and in biostatistics, what's your next challenge? What are you working on now, and what do you anticipate working on in the near future?
Thank you for that question. And this is a very difficult question because I moved to Yale about 2 years ago. And the reason I moved to Yale was that I had data equity in my job title. And I think I posted on LinkedIn that I'm the only person in the world with data equity in my job title. And I did learn an algorithm to search very carefully. So a place like Yale, an organization which has existed for 325 years, disseminating high quality education and research, putting a name to a program was of great value to me. And that immediately drew attention. So we are trying to establish a program in data equity in terms of generating research, developing a concentration down the road in terms of responsible AI and data equity. What I'm working on right now is actually applying some of these classical statistical principles to generative AI. I do think that the same problems with selection bias of leaving out people in the training corpora, just focusing on the users in terms of data set, are happening over and over again. So I just launched a new course this semester on that paper that you mentioned, Rosemary, but explaining each of the chapters so that this can be on sort of a guide towards practicing data equity. And this is called Ethics and Equity in Data Science and Artificial Intelligence. And I'm writing an ebook on it with my teaching fellow so that people have a sort of a guideline and a roadmap of how this is not just abstract and idealism. It can be practiced. That has been sort of my mission. I also want to spend quite a bit of time in India. And we just launched a summer program in India. India is very strong in medicine. India is very strong in statistics. But the two worlds coinciding and intersecting and defining a good model for biostatistics and health data science is still lacking. So one of my dreams in life is to start a high quality biostatistics institute in India. So next year I'll be on sabbatical, sort of planting the seeds of that idea and see where it takes me.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Brahmar, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes,
today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, John and Rosemary, for your wonderful work and for giving me the opportunity to share with your audience.
Oh, you're welcome. Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media Journalism and Film. You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or other places where you find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on our program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net. Be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.